From the nation's capital, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, the program today is about successful probation practices in Travis County, Texas, where they have reduced recidivism over the course of the last 6 years and have saved taxpayers in excess of $21 million. Our guest today is Dr. Geraldine Nagy, Director, Travis County Community Supervision and Corrections. And Geraldine, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Geraldine, you know, this is a program that is received a lot of publicity. There are a lot of, you know, notices in the literature that I read and the people that I talk to about the wonderful things that you have done down there in Travis County, Texas, in terms of probation. And in essence, one of the things we said before hitting the recording button is that, you know, you've basically taken a probation department and have gone beyond the usual instructions of most probation departments, which is to follow the orders and the mandate of the courts. And what you have done is actually reduced recidivism, which means reducing new criminal offenses. You've saved taxpayers literally tens of millions of dollars. How did you do all that?
Well, it took a lot of people doing a lot of work, but it began with a very honest look at probation and probation in Travis County, but probation in general. And we decided that our mission in Travis County would not only be to make sure that people comply with their conditions of probation, but we had a responsibility to do what we could to reduce crime in Travis County, Texas, through our interactions with the probationers. So we redefined our role and we expanded our mission, and we put numerous changes in place in order to accomplish that.
Now, you've had a 17% reduction in recidivism, and that's based upon what, new arrest?
That's new arrest statewide, so it's any kind of arrest in the state of Texas.
Okay.
And that's an average reduction.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And for Travis County, it would be, what would be the recidivism rate? Was it still 17%?
The recidivism rate at this point is 24%.
That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing, and the fact that you've been able to save $21 million in the process.
Yes. You know, I think there are a lot of things that are remarkable about this. I think, first of all, it hasn't required a huge infusion of money into Travis County probation.
Mm-hmm.
We've basically did our processes and cost efficiency and stay focused on that goal of protecting the public and reducing recidivism, and evaluated everything we did with that goal in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of what we've been able to do has been a better utilization of resource and just taking a more focused approach to what we do.
Now, this whole idea of evidence-based practices, what you did was to take a look at the literature, take a look at the research, and basically said to the folks when you were hired, I think I can do a better job utilizing the research, bringing evidence-based practices to Travis County, Texas, and I think I can reduce recidivism, and I think I can save taxpayer dollars. What was their reaction to your proposal?
You know, what I found with probation officers and the managers and the leadership here is that everyone was on the same page with regards to having probation being meaningful and being able to measure the results with measures that matter to other folks in the community, the judges, the people who live here and things. And so I didn't get a lot of resistance from staff.
Mm-hmm.
I think average probation officer back in the older days really would have wished that if they had known to have this information available so that they could do their jobs better. So I think there was some excitement about new opportunities, and so there wasn't a lot of resistance from staff. It required a lot of education.
Mm-hmm.
It required strong leadership throughout our organization, but people were willing to try something new if they thought it was going to make a difference.
Well, I've been in the criminal justice system for 42 years. As somebody, if I was doing something the same way for 20 years and somebody came along and said, Leonard, we're going to try an entirely new way of conducting public affairs, I would be very anxious. I would say, oh, my heavens, look, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Well, and yeah, and I'm sure some people felt that way. And but you know, I just felt that it was so important not to diminish what they had been doing.
Right.
They had been doing what they had been doing quite well. They
right.
were serving the court quite well. And so this was not saying that what they had done was wrong or unimportant, but they could do more. And that we could reallocate our resources, and we could actually reduce their caseloads
mm-hmm.
by being smarter
mm-hmm.
how we did things, so that they could make a difference with their folks. And so, yeah, I'm sure there was some anxiety, some not knowing, but I think that's part of making any meaningful change. And people, for the most part, you know, stuck with it. Our turnover rate has been very low. And I see a big difference in how people relate to their jobs now.
Can I ask you whether or not is your belief that most probation agencies in this country follow your model? My guess would be that most do not. My guess would be that most still follow a very traditional model of basically doing what the courts ask them to do and to follow the mandate of the courts. It's quite a change to go over to a model that basically said, hey, I'm going to make things dramatically better.
I think there's a growing interest in evidence-based practices and making changes at the local level. I think there's some challenges to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what is different from Travis County is we were successful in really, over the course of the years, doing a top-to-bottom change to bring us into alignment with a broad array of knowledge and research. And I think that that requires a great deal of planning and doing it in a very methodical way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the 10-step guide, which describes the process that we went through. It's to give some assistance for people who know what to do, but they aren't quite sure how to do it, because it is a complex change that
well,
takes time.
From the list,
there's a lot of interest.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, oh, I'm done.
Okay. It's just the list that I'm looking at includes so many things in terms of motivational interviewing. I just did a radio show on motivational interviewing, redesigning conditions of supervision, a uniform policy on sanctions, reduced caseloads in the regular units, a felony revocation staffing and review committee, a technical violation court document, a mental health integrated services program. I mean, I could go on and on and on about this list, a reentry drug court, a DWI. I court for repeat offenders, an absconder unit, web-based interactive workforce, redesign of the sex offender management program, establishing a counseling center for intensive outpatient operations. I mean, enhanced job skills training, retooling of job performance measures. That's a lot, Geraldine. That is just a huge
yes,
amount of
it
work.
It is a lot. And, you know, I think our key was to do a lot of planning up front, you
mm-hmm.
know, planning to plan.
Mm-hmm.
This is an important step, because I think the mistake that many people make when they start significant change is they throw something out without a lot of warning
right.
about why they're doing it and how it fits with the bigger picture. So we really worked on educating folks. We worked on working very closely with our judges, our prosecutors, our defense bar. And we really, you know, one person cannot do this. Even your top administrative team cannot do this.
Right.
It needs to be leadership at all levels throughout the organization. So we had to develop folks to be able to manage work groups and produce products and to work fairly independently. And that took the first year. So there's some development that has to take place. But the second most critical thing is putting a structure in place to actually implement things and manage the work so that it gets done. And I think that's what we did here in Travis County that brought us quite a bit of success much sooner than I expected. So I think that was key.
You had to sell this to, I would imagine, the court, the county commissioners, local law enforcement, your treatment partners. You had to sell this to lots of different people, correct?
Yes. I think for probably the first year, I did 30 or 40 different presentations.
Wow.
To community groups, to commissioner's court, to the prosecutor's office, to the county attorney's office,
right.
to commissioners, because I felt that what we needed to have is a clear understanding of what we were going to do, why we were going to do it, what I expected the outcomes to be, and to build confidence in our department. Because we are not a county entity. We are a judicial entity. We're mm-hmm. funded primarily through the state. So I needed to build those alliances. And yes, we needed support. We worked very closely with many people.
Geraldine, what's the essence of the program? I mean, I just read a long list of the individual initiatives, some of the individual initiatives that you took on, that you implemented. What is the heart and soul of probation agencies in order for them to be successful, in order for them to have the same results that you've had there in Travis County? What's the secret sauce? What is the heart and soul of it? If you could give an elevator speech in terms of what makes for a successful probation agency, it would be what?
I think it's working with the local system collaboratively as a whole, and secondly, creating a culture that knows how to make decisions, relies heavily on research and data, and will take an honest look at itself and change when it needs to. And so our way of doing business is probably the biggest change. You listed some of the things that we did.
Mm-hmm.
But probation is a living, dynamic sort of thing, and there are always new problems, there are always new issues, and those need to be based on research and evaluation rather than opinion or emotion. And so we've taken a different approach to how we do business.
Now, in terms of the offender population, you assess them. Correct.
Right. Yeah, and assessment is a foundation of effective probation. So
right.
Apart from what I just said, if you say one thing, it's in order to be effective, we must know who we're dealing with.
Right.
On an individual level. So we need to know how likely they are to reoffend. We need to know what issues are contributing to their criminal behavior. And then we need to develop strategies, either through probation supervision or treatment, to focus on those specific areas. But the foundation is assessment, and the foundation for the courts as well is assessment, because they set the conditions of probation.
Right.
That's the start.
Now, once you have an assessment, what do you do with them? I mean, do you divide them into high risk and low risk and provide different strategies based upon levels of risk?
Yes. You know, if you were to look at the research, it would say one thing that I think cannot be disputed. That is, if you over-supervise, over-treat low-risk people, people who have support in their lives, have a lesser criminal history, they're unlikely to reoffend,
mm-hmm.
then you will do them harm.
Mm-hmm.
They are actually more likely to go out and commit a new crime. If you take your high-risk person and you only see them monthly, for example,
right.
and send them to a treatment that is not very intensive, you can pretty much expect that they will go out and commit a new crime frequently. So the idea is that we reallocate our resources and sort these folks, for lack of a better word, so that we know who to spend our time with. So it's really similar to the emergency room. You know, you expect to go in there for people to triage
mm-hmm.
the people. Same thing should happen in a probation department, because it really is, in some cases, you know, life or death for a potential victim in the future. I mean, that might be the rare case, but still, we're making important decisions here.
Well,
and
go ahead.
So it's important to be informed. It's important to be fully informed and to respond to that. You know, the key, I think, for probation departments, many do assessments. It's how they are used by the courts, by the probation officer, at the point that there's a non-compliance, at the point in deciding should this person get off probation, all of those are key decision-making points. So the assessment needs to be utilized at each of those decision points.
My guest today is Dr. Geraldine Nagy. We're halfway through the program. Dr. Nagy is director of Travis County Community Supervision and Corrections, well established within the literature as having one of the most successful probation programs in the country, a significant reduction in recidivism, a savings to taxpayers of over $21 million, and that's why we have Geraldine at the microphones again today. The high-risk offender, Geraldine, has to receive the bulk of the services. The low-risk offender, you're talking about a danger of over-supervising them. That's something a lot of people have a hard time understanding. So the judge sentences this person to probation, and he's been in touch with the criminal justice system a couple times for, say, nonviolent crimes. He doesn't have a substance abuse history. Is that the kind of person we're talking about for low risk?
Yeah, and there are two types of low-risk folks. Some it's a situational one-time thing. You know, they're corrected at the point of arrest. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do it again. So those would be, you know, our low that we supervise in very large caseloads. There's other low-risk folks that do have some issues, maybe some treatment requirements, and so we put them in treatment. But it would be a lesser intensity treatment than what we would provide for a high-risk person.
I had a
longer history there.
I had a judge one time said, be careful when you ask for treatment for low-risk offenders, because if I impose those conditions of entreatment, those conditions of treatment are enforceable. And so the person doesn't like the program, doesn't like the group, doesn't like the facilitator of the group, and the treatment modality doesn't fit that particular person's needs. You know, if you're telling me, if you come back and tell me that he's not in compliance, that could possibly end up, you know, spending some, I could possibly send that person back to jail or prison. So be careful what you ask for. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, yeah. And, you know, low-risk people, exactly like you have described, have been going to Texas prisons for some time. I mean, there's our legislative budget board looking at who exactly is going to prison in the state of Texas. And there's a substantial number of low-risk people that end up in the state prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, piling on excessive conditions for low-risk people puts them at greater risk of being revoked, but it also puts them, if they comply, in situations where they're interacting with high-risk people, but it also interferes with their ability to do the things that make them low-risk, like maintain employment,
mm-hmm.
do what they need to do with their children and families. So there's a number of reasons that low-risk people need to be supervised less. But the greatest one is, if you're supervising them, you can't supervise the high-risk.
Right.
So at the level that you should. So that really is, when I talked about the allocation of resources, one of the biggest shifts in our department was moving that attention to high-risk people. So now they're watched more closely, but they're also have more requirements, and there's that constant interaction to make sure that they're benefiting from those requirements.
Now, it's interesting, well over, I guess, 35 years ago, I remember when I left law enforcement and went to college and started studying criminology, there was a book I read many decades ago called Radical Non-Intervention that said exactly that. Be careful of what you do with a low-risk offender. Sometimes the best thing you can do is not interact with that person as interact with that person as little as possible. Don't bring them full bore into the criminal justice system. You're going to create more problems than you solve. So that concept's been around for decades.
Yeah. You know, not everybody understands the concept, because I think not everyone realizes that we have the tools and methods to identify those low-risk folks well.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, goes back to assessment. So I often hear people that say, oh, no, you know, that's not going to work. What if there's one person? And the question is, can we do a good job in making those judgments with the tools that we have?
Right.
And, yes, much better much better than we could than we did before, certainly when we just kind of looked at a person and said, oh, you look low risk and you look high risk.
Right. And using the tools. It's not perfect. I mean, it's not 100%, but I've been told by people in the field that it does approach 80-85% accuracy.
Well, and low risk is not no risk. You know, it's important for us to recognize that.
Right.
But still, when you look at the research over and over and over again, it shows that if you over-supervise or treat these folks, they are more likely to go out and commit crime. In other words, it doesn't stop them. It makes them more likely.
So now you have the resources to focus on the higher-risk offenders. Now they come into contact with your probation officers on a much more frequent basis. They can keep a stronger eye on them, and you can get them involved in the programs that they need, because there's a substance abuse history for the bulk of offenders. There are mental health issues for a large percentage of offenders on criminal caseload. So now you can get them involved in the programs, and now you can keep a much better eye on them, and hopefully through the programs and through the supervisions, lower their recidivism risk.
Right. And, you know, we did a lot of training with our officers to build the skills to be able to do that well. You mentioned one of those things, motivational interviewing, which is really a strategy for assisting offenders to break through denial and to make a commitment to action-oriented steps to deal with their drug addiction, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, making sure that they're addressing the things that for that particular individual put that person at risk of committing another crime. So there's a different level of interaction between the officers and probationer now.
And it's not necessarily confrontational in terms of reading them the Riot Act. Again, motivational interviewing is breaking down, as you said, breaking down those barriers and getting the person to understand what it is they did and the steps that they need, cognitive behavioral therapy, or what some people call thinking for a change, getting them to think differently about who they are and what they do. And that's proven to be successful.
You know, if we want to really make a change in a person, we all know that we have to change their thinking, and we have to get them to recognize for themselves the importance of the change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what motivational interviewing and supervision is about. It's really helping that person take responsibility and giving them the tools, now that they know they need to take responsibility, how can they solve problems? You know, how can they manage their impulsivity? Those are just two examples.
But it's interesting that there's a lot of people within the criminal justice system, let alone outside of the criminal justice system, who, you know, they sort of scoff at this concept of motivational interviewing, and they sort of scoff at this concept of incentives for good behavior on probation, yet these are the things that seem to prompt change in terms of people who desperately need to change.
You know, one of the things that we do now is we do what is called a fidelity study, in which we look at case files and evaluate individual officers in the department as a whole as to how much they're adhering to these new strategies at
mm-hmm.
the officer level.
Mm-hmm.
Just an example, we think that probation officers don't matter. I have in front of me a preliminary study, but it looks to see, do offenders who have an officer that does a very good job on their supervision agreement or plan,
mm-hmm.
does that have a relationship with revocation and recidivism?
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that those officers that do well have offenders with a 17% reduction in technical revocation, a 10% reduction in revocations as a whole, and they're unlikely, less likely to have arrest. At 12% level,
mm-hmm.
that's just one little element. So I guess what I'm trying to say here and want to be clear about it, that quality of what that officer does with the offender starts with this plan, and people who have a good, solid plan are significantly less likely to be revoked. A 10 and a 17% reduction is great for this one small little
sure.
area. And a 12% reduction in recidivism. So officers matter. They make a difference in what they do in that office with the probationer. And that's what this is all about, really changing that interaction so that people are successful.
Well,
that's probably the biggest change we've made.
Well, I think it is. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up, because you see motivational interviewing and people just don't understand how important it is for that officer to guide that individual in terms of the proper way of conducting their lives, and that the officer's embracing of motivational interviewing. Maybe there needs to be a different a way of phrasing it or describing it, but that seems to be the heart and soul in terms of getting people to do what it is they should have been doing from the beginning.
You know, when I go to a doctor and he just doesn't even look up to me and reads from a chart, and we don't have an interaction, I think I'm less likely to comply with what he's told me to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if, as a very engaging conversation, listens to me, talks about my problems, and problem solves with me, I am likely to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of probation. I think that's true with a probation officer. And so that's really what we switched from, is going through routine process and a checklist to actually having a problem-solving session with somebody who's trying to help you solve your problems, whether it be drug abuse or impulsivity or hanging around with the wrong friends or not having a job, any of those. And so I just think I believe have proven that it makes a difference, and it's a viable alternative to having people go to prison, which is very costly, and has all sorts of other ramifications for our society. But it's a viable alternative to doing that where they don't get that sort of assistance.
We've had 3 minutes left in the program. You know, Project Hope in Hawaii, which was able to reduce recidivism and returns to prisons significantly, you know, it was interesting that they responded very quickly to violations in terms of incarcerations. But one of the things that I was really sort of surprised about is that, you know, their focus on programs, it was really a change in philosophy in terms of how you deal with the offender, in terms of both motivational interviewing and enforcing the conditions of supervision rather stringently. And I remember asking about the impact of programs, and programs were an important part of it, but not necessarily the most important part of it. Do you feel that that's true there for Travis County?
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things I want to make sure I'm not misunderstood about is that while officers are working with people to change, they're also an officer of the court. And so those officers that are able to maintain that authority and hold people accountable are also more effective in getting people to take responsibility for their actions and to change.
Right.
And I think that's what Project Hope does, is very quickly it shows that, you know, this is serious business.
Right.
And that's what we expect our officers to do as well.
Right.
Now, the response needs to be appropriate. We don't want to throw somebody in prison, but jail, I think, can be a very useful tool.
Yeah, well, certainly in terms of Travis County and Project Hope in Hawaii, that seems to have been borne out by the data. Do you feel that you have parole and probation agency in the country feels that they have all the resources necessary in terms of mental health, in terms of drug treatment, in terms of job assistance, but do you feel that you have enough for your higher risk offenders?
No. You know, and there's probably no director that's going to, as you said, say the answer to that is yes. But we have a certain issue here in Texas. People are funded by the number of people that are on probation.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened in Travis County is we get more successful as a community, as a criminal justice system, and diverting low-risk people, even from prosecution and sentencing to people to probation rather than to prison. Our population is changing,
mm-hmm.
So our population is going down, meaning we get less funding for operations because we don't have all these low-risk folks on probation anymore. But so our caseloads are almost all high and medium risk,
right?
And yet we're not getting training for that.
And
so
that's
some challenges. And funding.
That's got to be a huge challenge. All right. Now, you've been written up so often, and accolades have come your way. So what is your principal advice to other directors of parole and probation throughout the United States, or for that matter, throughout the world?
Well, you know, I think that people often don't initiate major change because they know that it's going to be difficult, and they anticipate all the challenges from the beginning. And what I would say to other directors is... success when you're dealing with any major change. In the middle, it can look like failure. You know, I can look at people who have created change in our culture, and then in the middle, there were substantial challenges. And the way that I see that is that those challenges are just part of the puzzle. So don't stop because you don't have solutions to those from the get-go. People will help you solve those problems.
I want to thank you for that. Our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, has been Dr. Geraldine Nagy, Director, Travis County Community Supervision and Corrections. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We want to thank you for all of the contact. We're up to 133,000 requests on a monthly basis for the radio, television shows, blog, and transcripts at media, media.csosa.gov. Please have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.